This is HPC Wire Soundbite, your weekly source of commentary and insight on the HPC stories shaping the industry. With Michael Feldman, editor of HPC Wire, and Addison Snell, CEO of Intersect 360 Research. And now, here are your hosts, Michael Feldman and Addison Snell.
Sorry about that, Chief. Intel cuts Larrabee off at the knees. Will xScale computing do the same for climate change deniers? Hello, everyone, and good morning for HPC Wire Soundbite for December 11th, 2009, available every Friday on iTunes. I'm Michael Feldman, editor of HPC Wire, and we have with us once again Addison Snell, CEO of Intersect 360. Good morning, Addison.
Hey, Michael, how are you?
Pretty good. Well, at the end of our last podcast last week, we were wondering if there was going to be any big HPC news for the rest of the year. Basically, an hour after we finished our conversation, Intel announced the cancellation of the Larrabee debut for 2010.
Yeah, it didn't take long, did it?
No, it was like, we're thinking, okay, Christmas, everybody's wrapping it up for the year. We'll never see any big news again. And Intel just kind of drops its bombshell on everyone.
They snuck that one in there, hoping no one would notice.
Yeah, on late Friday afternoon. Well, Addison, every analyst and his brother has been chiming in on this news, so I'm going to give you your chance. What's your take on Intel's announcement?
Well, the first thing that I have to say about it is that, this as an analyst, you're always trying to put your opinion out in the industry and talk about things you think are going to happen or game changers out on the horizon. And we've been looking at Larrabee for a long time and saying both to our clients and publicly that we thought Larrabee was a potential game changer in what it could bring to accelerators, the GPU computing market, and whoops, so that one gets pushed out, and I'm sitting here in Silicon Valley. I can hear NVIDIA licking its chops from here. You were always a little more skeptical than I was about Larrabee, so that's a point for you.
Well, at the beginning, when they first started talking about Larrabee in 2007, I thought it had a lot of potential, and I was very, very much up on it. The longer it got drawn out, and the more AMD, and then especially NVIDIA, came on and sort of took on that mantle of GPU computing, the less enamored I became of Larrabee, and it just seemed to slip further and further into the distance, and especially as sort of the GPU computing software ecosystem seemed to sort of coalesce around NVIDIA and CUDA, and then, even Microsoft has come in with Direct Compute, and now we have OpenCL as standards. I just thought, Intel is taking too long to jump in here, and now that they've basically canned the commercial release of the first product, I think they're really behind the eight ball.
Well, yeah, and what it really winds up reminding me of is what happened with their launch of the first generation Itanium chip with Merced. This isn't the first time analysts have gotten around to predicting big-time success with a new Intel technology, only to see the first generation fall flat. And Intel put a delayed Merced on the market, it was really only for future IA64 or EPYC development. And by the time McKinley came out, which was also delayed, which was the first really full production Itanium chip, AMD had kind of redefined the market around x86 with 64-bit extensions with Opteron, and the dynamics of the market had changed enough that Itanium never became everything it was supposed to be. So it's not like Intel is totally out of the game with Itanium, and it's not like they're completely out of the game either with graphics, but that's what I worry about with the Larrabee launch. It really reminds me a lot of what happened with Merced.
Right, that's a good point. And there's an additional challenge here in that, unlike the enterprise market back then, this new market that's developing of visualization computing and GPGPU and is just something that's emerging now, and it's new for everybody. But they were basically trying to redefine that market before it was ever established, and before they were ever established in it, on the graphics side or the GPU computing side. So it's sort of an additional challenge for them, and I think sort of it was the basic mistake they made. They never established themselves in that technology, and they're trying to redefine how everybody should do it.
Well, you made a little joke at the top of the podcast with your sorry about that, Chief, and the Larrabee namesake from Get Smart.
Yeah, I mean, it was strange. I remember thinking about this when they first started talking about Larrabee. They named it after this slow-witted, bumbling character on Get Smart, this 1970s sitcom, who was always apologizing because he was always screwing things up for the chief of control, and he was always going, sorry about that, Chief. And it's like, what kind of karma did they expect in naming that ship after Larrabee? But now it's just a little too close to home, I guess.
It all makes sense now, is what you're saying.
Yeah, it's
right?
Like, okay, everything fits together, but who knows what they were thinking. Or maybe it wasn't intentional, maybe it was an accident, but right now it's all too real.
Well, and then there's one other dynamic that I potentially wonder about with regards to the timing of the Larrabee thing, because one thing we did talk about in our podcast last week briefly is that the DOJ had just expanded its investigation of Intel into looking at the chipset agreement with NVIDIA and its potential future ramifications with the Larrabee chip, with the cancellation of Larrabee coming 2 days after that was publicly unveiled. I have to wonder whether it wasn't an influencer in the decision, if the potential legal cost for Larrabee got too high in the cost-benefit equation. And I think that's something we're just never going to know, but it does make me scratch my head and wonder if that was an influence.
Yeah, I think that's something we never will know, even to what extent the legal proceedings between those two companies had to do with the Larrabee decision. One of the analysts I talked about in my blog, actually the reporter, Bob Cringely, actually thinks this is going to be the opportunity where Intel actually buys NVIDIA. Now that Larrabee's out of the picture, it sort of leaves the antitrust concerns behind, and now they can go in and actually hook up like he thought they should always do. Now, I don't agree with that, and I think most analysts don't agree that that's going to be a marriage made in heaven, but at least this one industry watcher thinks so, and it's just, I don't think that's going to happen.
Well, I mean, it's interesting from the standpoint of from a technology perspective. I would agree that it's actually a good fit and is fairly complementary. But the analysis of that boils down to a fairly elementary discussion of if you can't beat them, join them. Right. The thing is, I feel like NVIDIA and Intel have almost gotten a little too entrenched in thinking of each other first as partners and then as enemies. I don't see that merger, that acquisition in my crystal ball right now, but you know, I've been proven wrong on stuff before, and I'll get proven wrong on stuff again, but it's an interesting viewpoint at least.
Yeah, it is, and you're right, it does make a good fit from a technology point of view. I mean, it really does complement both sides, especially because Intel is sort of big on integrated graphics, but they have no discrete GPU, and they have no GPU right. Computing story obviously now, but you know, just seeing you know, what happened at the GPU technology conference and the CEO Jensen talk about, you know, their business philosophy and how they view the other competitors in the field makes me think like that could never happen. There's just no cultural similarities that are going to allow that to happen, except in a very hostile way. I mean, I guess there could always be a hostile takeover, but you know, you've got a company to think about and you've got to merge those two cultures together, and I just don't see that happening. So,
well, and speaking of looking into crystal balls, you wrote a blog that just fairly innocently, but with an opinion, looked ahead to the future of Exascale and what its potential role might be in looking at climate change long term. Wow, did you set off a big discussion. You waded right in the middle of climate gate with that one, Michael.
Yeah, anytime you start talking about climate change, you're going to attract some controversy. Now, my main point here was Exascale computing. People are starting to sell Exascale computing, obviously, not just vendors, but the academicians as well, the research people. But one of the ways they're trying to sell it is that it's going to, you know, be able to help solve our climate change problems and then our associated energy problems in switching from carbon-based fuels to non-carbon-based fuels. And my point was, we shouldn't be selling Exascale that way, because the changes, the major changes that need to be done to remediate global warming and the climate change that's going going on and to get started on our energy solutions for the next decade have to take place today with the technology we have today. We can't wait for xScale computing to come along to help solve our problems. It's going to be too late. We're talking about, you know, the latter half of the next decade. That's 8 years down the road. And, you know, if you believe the guys who are running the models, we don't have 8 years. In fact, we're already late on taking action. We need to do the stuff this year. We need to do it yesterday. We can't wait for xScale computing. Now, of course, people, you know, I got plenty of comments, and some people are saying, well, like, that's not really the way it is, but we're going to be doing this forever, and I do realize that. But
well, taking the climate change doubters and setting that aside for a moment, you're really dealing with two issues that are both enduring. One is the pace of computing, which is continuing, and the other is long-term climate change modeling and forecasting, which is also an enduring topic. Climate change was a huge application when we first hit the mega scale. It's first a big application when we first hit gigascale and terascale and petascale, and it's still going to be a big application when we hit exascale. It's a wonderful application area that has arbitrary degrees of complexity that you can always look at more closely at longer time scales, at higher fidelity, with more variables, modeling in the sun and the trees and the oceans and the birds and the people. I mean, there's all kinds of complexity you can bring into climate. It's not going to be a solved problem 20 years from now when we're running on exascale computers. But your point is that it can help drive exascale development in terms of you always want to hang a carrot out there and say, if we have a more powerful computer, here's something we can do with it. And this is something we'll be able to do with it. That doesn't mean we shouldn't be trying to solve climate change problems with the terascale, petascale computers we've got now.
Right. And I wasn't trying to insinuate that either. I think we should do it the most. And I don't think we should ever stop the research in doing this. You're right. It's going to be an ongoing problem. It's just the crisis, the thing that we need to do in the next 10 years needs to be done in the next 10 years and hopefully sooner than that. And I think sort of the message becomes somewhat simplified sometimes because, you know, like we've been talking, climate change does draw people's attention and it's a way to sell, you know, research programs and machines and all this other stuff. And I don't think we should oversimplify what we need to do today to get to these machines. There's plenty of great applications out there. By the time we get there, we'll have plenty of problems to solve. And like you said, this will be an ongoing problem. Our energy problems will be ongoing as well. They'll just be different problems in 10 years than they are today.
Great. I think you're right looking at the difference in the problems on an ongoing basis. This is an enduring thing we have in this industry that I like about it, that we've mentioned before, is what's fun about this industry is the applications that people solve with these fantastic machines. That's something we're going to get to continue to look forward to. Next week, we have our last podcast of the year, so it might be fun to take a look back at the year that was and also maybe each make some predictions about the future.
Hey, that sounds like fun. I can't believe it went by so fast. But, yep, next year or next week will be our last podcast of the year right before Christmas. And, you know, maybe we'll see some new news. But if not, we're just going to do the look back. And there's been plenty of news, obviously, in this past year. It's been an exciting year for the community. So until then, I guess we'll be talking to you next week, Addison.
Looking forward to it as always, Michael.
You've been listening to HPC Wire Soundbite with Michael Feldman and Addison Snell. Got a question or comment for Michael or Addison? Email soundbite@hpcwire.com. HPC Wire Soundbite is available every Friday afternoon from iTunes or at hpcwire.com. HPC Wire, the leading source for global news and information covering the ecosystem of high productivity computing.